there was a very good idea to combine the idea of competitive governance with something that we know already worked throughout history, which is special economic zones. Right, so special economic zones arguably have a history that's more than 1,000 years old, right? So they've always been a laboratory for governance innovation. And the idea is it's just too hard to change the code, the code base of the big operating system, right? So there's so many entrenched interest groups, so it's too hard to do changes on a national scale. So why don't we fork off like a small part or territory? Right. So what used to become like city states or something like that, and they can sort of have they have legal autonomy and can innovate in ways that makes them an attractive jurisdiction to go to or to come to.
Welcome back, everybody, to the podcast. It's my pleasure to introduce you to my friend Nicholas Anzinger. Nicholas is general partner at Infinita Fund, a VC investing in frontier technology and the Startup Cities movement. He's based in Prospera, Honduras, one of the leading startup cities, a prototype of the Balagian network state model. He hosts the excellent Stranded Technologies podcast, my favorite podcast these days, and was a successful company founder and operator in the tech field. He studied economics, philosophy, and international relations in Germany and the US, and worked at several DC think tanks. He now invests in deep tech and companies that benefit from regulatory arbitrage. On a personal level, Nicholas is a good friend on the same wavelength as myself and many in the deep tech and Web3 fields. He's quite conscientious and a rigorous thinker with a catalog of practical solutions to the statist regulatory afflictions that ail us and hold back science and technology today. So with that, I hope you enjoy my interview with Nicholas Anzinger. Okay, great. So thanks, Nicholas, for joining. We've been friends for a while now. We spent time together at Zuzalu, and you know, it's a pleasure to finally have you on the podcast. So maybe you can start us off by telling the listeners about yourself, your story, what your fund, Infinita Fund, is doing, and we can go from there.
Sure. Great to be on, Sebastian. Big admirer of your work and of DeSci, and avid listener of the DeSci podcast as well, of course. There's been some mutual guests that we had on the DeSci podcast and the Stranded Technology podcast that I do. Yeah, but myself, I'm originally from Germany and now I've been nomadic for 3 years. I turned from researcher to startup operator to now entrepreneur and venture capitalist, right? So in my period as a researcher, I spent too much time in academia and school, and I worked for Washington DC policy think tanks, and I thought this is how you create kind of the changes that I wanted to see, right? I studied philosophy and economics and, you know, wanted to create a big change in the world, but I found that that was not the way to go. It's just too slow and stale. So I went instead into tech and entrepreneurship, and I just found that I'm much better fit with my temperament, just the dynamism and also just the template and the playbook, the ability to start small organizations that create very big changes. I find that to me a more inspiring way to kind of create that kind of future I want to see. Just build it yourself instead of trying to reform large organizations that have entrenched interests where it's this constant uphill battle. And now with the VC fund Infinita that I'm doing now, I'm basically bringing those two together. I want to sort of inspire a movement that's using competitive governance and startup societies to create sort of change on the governance level that is allowing innovation to flourish, right? And as a background, and we'll talk a bit about that, I think there's a lot of technology out there. Biotech and healthcare is a perfect example, or longevity. But also hardware, the world of atoms, right? Nuclear power, for example, or drones, right? And in crypto, there's a constant battle against the regulators. And I think with a better regulatory paradigm, we could really unleash a new wave of technological progress that's been held back for a very long time. So this is the work that I focus on with Infinita Fund, kind of finding startups that are kind of downstream of startup societies, or what Balaji Srinivasan calls network states, sometimes called special jurisdictions or startup cities, and kind of use sort of better legal guardrails to increase kind of the innovative power, reduce iteration times to innovate, reduce fixed costs, right? So examples are, I invested in biotech companies, including your own, ImmunH Pharma, because I think it's very clever how you use Puerto Rico tax credits as a jurisdictional play. Also in two drone companies. One of them is based in a startup city called Prospera that we'll probably get to talk about. And also in sort of two crypto legal plays that's also trying to use or sort of having their own jurisdiction with sort of better laws and more clear regulations when it comes to digital assets and crypto.
Excellent. Thanks for that introduction. And glad to have you as an investor in ImmuneAge too. And I'll take the opportunity to plug your podcast, the Stranded Technologies podcast, which is probably my favorite podcast. And I listen to a lot of podcasts, okay? So it's my favorite podcast out there. Sorry if I've offended any other podcaster friends, but everybody needs to go stop what you're doing and check out the Stranded Technologies podcast. Getting
especially
into that.
Especially episode 15.
Yeah, 15.
Best yeah, ones ever on the podcast.
Yeah, the best one ever, the one we did together, episode 15 on longevity biotech. Maybe you can speak about a few of the guests that you've had on the podcast that you think the DeSci community might be interested in.
Yeah, episode 15, you gave an intro to DeSci and to longevity biotech and sort of how what the nexus is with crypto. Right. So this was really an eye-opening podcast for me and lots of my listeners and kind of drawing the connection. And I think we are touched on what we talk about today, why DeSci needs startup societies or startup cities and kind of physical sandboxes with a better regulatory paradigm to really flourish. So this is what we're going to talk about later. Other than that, there's super interesting episodes like episode 4 and 8, right? So Jessica Flanagan is a professor for philosophy. Raymond March is a public choice economist. And they're both talking about the FDA, both from a moral point of view and from an economic efficiency point of view. So the status quo is deeply morally flawed. That's something that Jessica is talking about. And it's also very inefficient when it comes to innovation, when it comes to actually producing safe and effective drugs, right? So that's not what it's doing. That's the purpose of it, but not the outcome. And other episodes that are noteworthy in the space, 46 with Patrick Linden, also a common friend of ours that we met at Zuzulu, also a philosopher who makes also the moral case for radical life extension and why sort of that age-old sort of aversion against the idea of immortality and extending human lifespan, why it's a good thing to do that, why it's a good thing to aspire to live longer and healthier. Right. So beyond what we consider right now, the natural boundaries or the natural state of affairs. Right. So these are great episodes for listeners of this podcast, of the DeSci podcast, that overlaps with the topics that you're discussing.
Great. Yeah. And, you know, for the technophiles among us who echo that Founders Fund Peter Thiel quip about, you know, they promised flying cars, we got 140 characters reflecting the apparent lack of technological advancement since, say, around the 1970s, you know, what happened? You and the people you interview seem to be single-handedly, you know, trying to overcome that trend. And so you speak with people doing radical deep tech projects like modular nuclear reactors and supersonic flight and longevity and synthetic biology and so on. So it's really the go-to place to hear, you know, what is the latest and greatest in technology. You know, the Foresight Institute has a lot of people in the nanotech field as well. So that kind of vibe. So there's definitely a lot of overlap. For people who are interested in going to a DeSci gathering, there are gatherings all over the world now, you know, just in the last 3 years since we really kicked off this movement. I've been impressed to see all of these meetup groups and spontaneous activity happening, which really indicates how much market need there is, how fed up scientists are with the current structure. But the flagship jewel in the crown event is coming up in Berlin in September, the DeSci Berlin conference. So if you're interested, you should attend that. It was excellent last year. Okay, going back to Infinita, maybe you can talk briefly about some of the portfolio companies that you've invested in already and some that you're looking at. You don't have to be specific, but the sort of areas that you're interested in, the regulatory arbitrage thesis.
Yeah, so I have three buckets, basically biotech and healthcare, hardware, and sort of finance or digital assets, right? So when it comes to healthcare and biotechs, I want to see things that kind of break with the current paradigm in healthcare in meaningful ways, right? So either you go to a different place where you get sort of regulatory advantages to do faster clinical trials or to get tax credits like you do in Puerto Rico. There's a company called MiniCircle and Prosper that's doing faster clinical trials. There is, and also I'm interested in companies that also want to reduce the need for third-party providers, for example, right? So I'm going to invest in the first ever investment in a Honduran company called Dr. Seven that is basically reducing the need for third-party providers for insurance for like very basic needs, right? So you can just have a very simple telemedicine health doctor for a subscription price, sort of with the lower price point of Honduran doctors that are providing it in Spanish-speaking country worldwide. Honduras has a doctor surplus, which is very rare in the world, right? The second bucket in hardware, I invested in two drone companies. So the bet is that Latin America will be the place where drones take off. What not many people know, what speaks kind of to that regulatory flaw, is that the biggest drone logistics company to date, Zipline, valued at several billions right now, they're started not in the United States, in Silicon Valley. I mean, that's where they're also headquartered, or is it Austin? But they started their first commercial drone operations in Rwanda, right? Just because drones are regulated like airlines in most jurisdictions in the world, owing to, and I had an episode 24 with Santiago Pinzon from Orchid, to kind of international sort of standards, or, you know, international regulations, sort of the cartels, they like to work together and sort of coalesce around sort of some of these regulations that are holding back the industry in many countries. You still have freedom, though, as a jurisdiction to do it differently. These constraints are not binding, which is good, right? So the bet is on smaller countries that take the leap forward when it comes to innovation in drones and hardware, and also hopefully for nuclear power and for you know, construction tech. And then sort of it scales to other and to bigger jurisdictions, especially in drones, the ones with high urban density. Yeah, because drones and air traffic will be tremendously important for the future of cities and of logistics. Just the price points are just much more competitive, and just the speed at which you can deliver certain things, especially in the regions of the world that are rapidly urbanizing. There's just a tremendous, tremendous upside from that. And these companies are breaking ground now in Quito, Ecuador, in Sao Paulo, Brazil, right? So this will be sort of unprecedented that we can do drones at city scale. So this is great. And the third bracket, sort of the digital assets or finance, there I'm specifically looking for interesting legal plays, right? So that's kind of a more higher bar threshold for me. You want to use something like Prospera to get a banking license or to get an insurance license, right? Because these are two terribly overregulated markets in almost any part in the world. So it's a very low-hanging fruit to do a new insurance company that sort of can iterate and start much, much faster, right? So in Germany, for example, or in, there's this insurance tech company in Brazil that raised the biggest early stage round in the history of Latin America with 35 million. And they had to, because insurance is such a hard market to break into because of like the capital requirements and just the licensing requirements. Like it costs between 1 to 5 million per insurance product to get licensed for. And there's a long laundry list of insurance products, right? So many insurance companies start in like auto insurance or something where the barriers are low. So that's just a good example for an industry that was just different legal requirements or guardrails. You could just massively unlock the value of it. So I made two investments in company. One is its own special jurisdiction, the Catawba Digital Economic Zone. So the bet there is it could be the safe haven for crypto in the United States, right? So by providing alternative to Delaware and corporation laws, where it's just very clearly defined what your digital assets, who has ownership of them, and that they're protected and they have property rights and things like that. And the second one is a company called Killbee, which is building sort of the crypto on off-ramp rails for fintechs in Latin America. Again, sort of to build a more liquid financial system, not from in the United States, but from outside, to just unleash the power of sort of a more borderless financial system.
Excellent. Cool, man. So moving on to the broader theme of competitive governance. So it really clicked for me when I heard, I think it was Patry Friedman grandson of Milton Friedman, one of the thought leaders in this competitive governance space, when he said, he quizzed us, what is the largest industry in the world? What is the largest sector of any economy? And people will say, oh, you know, maybe it's, you know, banking or it's military or whatever. But it's actually the government. It's the state. It is that entity, according to Max Weber, which claims a legitimate monopoly on the use of violence within a given territory, as the libertarians would describe it. And governments tend to provide poor quality of service in large part because they're monopolies. Like the DMV is not very good because there's only one option. And so what if we had more options? And this gets to Balaji's framing of it. I think he's borrowed this from another thinker of exit versus voice. So with voice, you try to stick around, go down with the sinking ship, you vote, you agitate politically, et cetera. In large empires like the United States or EU or Russia, it's not easy to do as a small faction. The alternative would be exit, where you vote with your feet. So many people throughout history have defected or moved to greener pastures. And indeed, we owe the formation of the United States as this crazy experiment to that example of exit. And at the time, it was this idea of radical freedom of religion. You've got all these weird, what we would call cults, spinoffs from you know, the dominant Anglican or whatever religion, and freedom of speech and everything we know and love and now sort of take for granted, and rights that are being eroded in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and so forth. And so that was cool, you know, 200 plus years ago, but maybe it's time for an upgrade. Maybe it's time for a new operating system for the most important sector of the economy, the most important area of human life in modern society, which is state action. And so many people will argue that the state should be bigger, that it should be smaller, that it should be doing different things. You don't have to agree on what the state should be doing. You just should agree that we should be allowed to experiment. And that is one of the great things about America that has made it anti-fragile, is that we have the states within the federal system. Federal system is arrogating more power to itself, but that gives it a little bit more stability, like Swiss cantons have the same situation. So how can we encourage the experimentation in new startup societies? Balaji refers to them as network states or network nations, all kinds of different terms now. And you know, people like Peter Thiel have been supporting this movement. Naval Ravikant is a supporter as well. But we have some, it's very new. It's, you know, it's in its later, its recent forms becoming more sophisticated with real, you know, countries with power over their civil code. But maybe you can give a couple examples of some of these projects. So Prospera is one that you know very well. You live in Prospera. There's Praxis. There was Zuzalu recently. So we can take those one at a time and just tell the listeners more about each of them.
Yeah, sure. The way I like to typically introduce competitive governance is, again, by, you know, now people know Balaji is the network state quite well. It's becoming a meme. I think it's a very strong net positive. It's bringing lots of ideas and talent into the space. And it's now brought us to an inflection point where I think we can create a larger movement, right? So that's a very positive, even though, but some of parts of the network states or much of the network state idea is a bit confusing to many people. So I typically put it in context, right? So think of it as a progression from like seasteading to charter cities to network state, right? So seasteading was the idea, as you just described, we need to try new things, right? So we know some of the things aren't working for everyone. Not everyone has a government or lives in a jurisdiction that they share values with, and they like to try out new things. There are some things that we fundamentally feel we are lacking and are not working for everyone. So why not do it on the ocean, right? Because there's no governance there. Didn't work for cost reasons. And then I think in the second iteration, there was a very good idea to combine the idea of competitive governance with something that we know already worked throughout history, which is special economic zones, right? So special economic zones arguably have a history that's more than 1,000 years old, right? So they've always been a laboratory for governance innovation. And the idea is it's just too hard to change the code, the code base of the big operating system, right? So there's so many entrenched interest groups, so it's too hard to do changes on a national scale. So why don't we fork off like a small part or territory, right? So what used to become like city states or something like that, and they can sort of have, they have legal autonomy and can innovate in ways that makes them an attractive jurisdiction to go to or to come to.
And I think just to jump in there with some case studies of this, you know, this has been happening for a long time. We've got Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Hong Kong, Singapore, Shenzhen, and many others. So, you know, one of the arguments is if you could create a new special economic zone startup society and you just own the land where it would be built on, you know, a multi-decade scale, you would get 10,000x returns as sort of at the risk of a real estate investment project. So that's one of the key sort of business model innovations that I'm really partial to. But yeah, please continue.
Exactly. And that's a massive one. I mean, these jurisdictions that you mentioned, Hong Kong, Singapore, Shenzhen, Dubai, they went from very poor hinterlands or from desert into wealthy mega cities in a short amount of time. And the iteration time also was reduced each time, right? So Hong Kong roughly took like 50 years to be developing country standards. Singapore, I think 35 or 40. Shenzhen, like 30, 35. And then Dubai, like 20 or 25, right? So that shows you that we are on to finding a scalable model to, well, reduce poverty and to upgrade just the value and of land and of opportunity for citizens to upgrade or supercharge their own life, right? So what if we can apply that formula and bring it scalably to more places in the world that really need it, right? Especially places that are poor, which is why I'm in Honduras with one of the most, if not the most advanced startup city, startup society project in the world, which is Prospera on the Caribbean island of Roatan. Right. And it's basically trying to bundle all the lessons that we learned from the examples that we mentioned. What would we need to create what Dubai has created or Singapore? It's common law based legal systems, right? And it's good governance, sort of institutions for dispute resolution, for arbitration, and for anything that you need to do business, right? So that means free markets, freedom of contract, and just reducing the barriers for entrepreneurs to do business. So that's basically it. So if you, there's nothing fundamentally new, right? There is a lot of best practices that have accumulated over history that we just need to put together in the right context and in scalable ways and sort of find enough friendly governments and jurisdictions that allow more projects like that to happen, which again has also the benefits for these nations or governments because they get tax revenue from it. And it's just very appealing to, you know, have a quicker way to become a developed country, right? That's what many people around the world aspire to. And that's a good thing to create prosperity for your life. So this is kind of what competitive governance is all about, right? Sort of creating a bigger opportunity space for, you know, for experiments in governance, for upgrading and supercharging economic development and growth.
Agreed. And, you know, the legal system is one of the things that makes it possible to do business in any country, right? There's the culture, there's the talent there, but it's the legal system is a big part of it. And people will move to take advantage of better legal systems. And a legal system, it's really just code. It's a code base effectively. And so you can copy and paste it to different jurisdictions. So, you know, Prospera, you can have a company incorporated there that is using Delaware law, for example, with foreign or arbitration. And so you can take the best of both worlds, which I quite like. And Prospera, you know, you live there. It's this beautiful Caribbean island. It's like 75,000 people or so living on the island. It's a major holiday destination. There are these beautiful new buildings being constructed by Prospera. So I think it's really going to take off. There was some tension with the new political party coming into power over the expansion of this special economic zone legislation, but it seems that that won't negatively affect Prospera going forward. It seems like, you know, they have a good plan to resolve it. But in any event, the cat is out of the bag, whether it's in Roatan or whether it's in Montenegro or in Uruguay or wherever. This kind of new idea, it's an idea whose time has come. There's nothing more powerful than that. So yeah. Moving to cities, you know, the modern society is not really adapted for optimal mental and physical health and just flourishing. You know, a lot of people will live in these big inhuman cities surrounded by cars and pollution and noise. Or they'll live, you know, in secluded places where they're isolated from people. They have to drive a long time in the countryside or whatever. So what if we could take the best of both worlds? What if we could have, you know, the nature, the peace and quiet, the good health environment, plus the community that you do get in these big cities? And so there are many experiments trying to rethink the city, you know, a city without cars, et cetera. And so this is an opportunity to marry that movement with an actual profitable business model. So people will actually buy into the city that you're building, and you can get a significant return from that. So we have people who are moving from, say, California or New York to Austin, Texas, or Miami, Florida, et cetera. But why not just go a step further? I mean, I myself have gone to Puerto Rico, still within the US. So there are some challenges in terms of certain, you know, innovative businesses you might want to do. But what if we go a step further and we go to friendly jurisdictions that actually want people to move there? You know, if they had thousands of high-level entrepreneurs and knowledge workers and high-skilled people, as well as investors bringing capital, that is, I think, what the next century will look like, is, especially with things like AI, the returns to IQ, the returns to intellectual work will increase, whereas, you know, the returns to capital, like physical capital or land, will probably decline a bit. And so whoever is able to attract the top talent globally will win in the future economy. And so we spent time in Montenegro recently at Zuzalu, which was organized by Vitalik Buterin, inventor of Ethereum, as well as Vita DAO, which is the leading bio DAO, longevity DAO that I advise. And it brought together several hundred people over a two-month period in this experimental pop-up city. And we had a series of conferences on AI, blockchain, zero knowledge proofs, longevity biotech, synthetic biology, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it was amazing the, you know, interesting, fascinating people that you met there and how many people wanted to go, but there was just not space. So it was oversubscribed. And that was not advertised. It was kept pretty quiet. It was not easy to get to Montenegro for most people. And so what if, and a lot of people who were there, who I spoke to, myself included, basically said, if this were occurring year round, I would live in that place. Especially if there were a special tax deal or ease of getting a visa, path to citizenship, et cetera. So there's a lot of low-hanging fruit in moving this sort of tech forward-thinking community to one of these friendly jurisdictions. And so there's a new party in power in Montenegro that is a technocratic government, relatively young guys, you know, former bankers and so on, who are interested in attracting this kind of community. And so we're in discussions with them about that. But I think there are many opportunities elsewhere in the world, so we can get into that. But I wanted to touch on another project called Praxis, which was also at Zuzalu. It's a little bit mysterious. It's not entirely clear, to me at least, what the plans are, but it seems like a smart team and a cool group. So there's also this Urbit community, which is based around this new operating system, but they also have these sort of startup city sympathies as well. So maybe you can tell us what you know about those groups.
Yeah, maybe we could also turn the conversation around a bit towards DeSci.
Sure.
Yeah, so my question to you would actually be, because many listeners that hear this are saying, well, I'm kind of fine where I am, right? I live in like New York or San Francisco or in Berlin. These are great cities, right? So there's so many things that I like about them. And I think it's important there to notice that that's totally fine, right? So these places are great, right? So we live in developed countries. We live at the in a stage of history that with unprecedented like wealth and opportunity. So what's important to note about these startup societies is that they're speaking to people kind of at the frontiers, sort of at, you know, so one is people that are in poverty and others are sort of technologists like us. So maybe we can turn the conversation towards longevity, biotech, and DeSci, because before I went into working on Infinita and this running technologies podcast and having our conversations, I didn't know that much about sort of the biotech world, right? And until I met you, until I met WitaDAO, it struck me that there's a high urgency to find these kinds of solutions, which maybe gives also your listeners an appreciation for why this is kind of important and urgent for them now if they care about DeFi and longevity. So maybe you can talk a bit about why it is that in the longevity community, in the DeFi community, that you feel this itch or this urgency to go somewhere or to sort of change something or go somewhere where you can innovate better.
Sure, yeah, you've teed that up quite nicely. So the greatest threat to any of our lives and livelihoods is illness, getting sick, getting old. And right now, it's the only guarantee in life that we will suffer and age and die. And governments spend significant amounts of their budget today on military and various other interests. But it's actually not foreign governments or even your own government that is the greatest threat to you today. It's actually aging and disease. So what if we had a society where we recognize that truth and we prioritized our capital, talent, attention toward biomedical research, particularly longevity, but also advanced technologies like synthetic biology and so forth. And so WitaDAO and Molecule and other organizations are sort of laying the groundwork for that kind of philosophy, as well as this organization that I'm involved with called Vitalism. It's a political movement. We say sort of jokingly, it's a religious movement like a cult, in that there's a religion shaped hole in the human psyche. Humans need some higher purpose and sort of community and aligned values and ethical principles. And it helps to, you know, make those explicit as a part of a religion. Or some people, for them, it's, you know, loving Disney films or loving Apple products, or their state, their nation state becomes their religion, right? Which can be unhealthy for sure. So that's kind of the thinking behind this longevity movement to create a longevity startup city network state. And there are some practical considerations too. So if you live in the US or Europe, you have centralized monopoly regulators. So the FDA, the EMA, for example, they tend to, again, like the DMV, not do the best possible job because they're a monopoly and very bureaucratic. They tend to be more corruptible. There's a regulatory capture occurring, this regulatory revolving door, it's called, where people in industry will go work with the regulators to benefit their industry contacts and cycle. There's also another issue with respect to not approving efficacious drugs fast enough. So there's the problem of inefficiency, the problem of corruption, but also the problem of related to inefficiency, which is that tip of the iceberg problem where there's so many people who are dying because they can't get access to medicines that should have been approved sooner or should have been approved, but were never approved. So there are drugs that you can get in Russia or Japan that you can't get in America. And, you know, the drugs you do get in America are like 10 times the cost of anywhere else. And so, you know, that's harmful. And maybe there's a way we could set up alternative third party, maybe free market based regulatory structures that are not prohibitive. They don't say to you and your doctor, hey, if the FDA has not approved this, you cannot use it on your own body. It's the same logic as recreational drugs. It's government saying, hey, you know, we don't think you should be able to use psychedelics. We don't care, you know, about the evidence. It's similar with many therapies, from stem cell therapies to peptides to drugs that are approved in other jurisdictions. So another factor here is the insurance. So in America, pretty much everybody relies on insurance for their medical care. And this creates a really perverse incentive. It creates an incentive to drive up costs because you aren't paying for it personally. You may pay 20% copay or something like that, but it doesn't create an efficient incentive. And so everyone, there was this quote, I think it was Bastiat, who said, you know, everyone wants to live at the expense of the state.
The state is the illusion by which everyone lives at the expense of everyone else. Yes,
exactly. Yes, exactly. And so everyone thinks they can get something for nothing. But as Milton Friedman and others said, there's no such thing as a free lunch. And you know, if you're consuming some good or service, someone had to work to produce it. And the state doesn't, generally speaking, the state doesn't produce value itself. It just sort of moves capital around and tells people what to do. in often inefficient way. So anyway, long story short, if you get cancer, in America, you have to go to the standard of care medical guideline. So you have to basically take the pill, the drug that your medical authority has said is the first one to take. If that doesn't work for you, then you can take the second one, the third one, et cetera. So this is sort of a union between the insurance, of which there are like four or five big insurance companies in America, which are highly profitable, and the medical guidelines, which are set by cabals of physicians mostly and government. And so that creates a bit of a problem, because how could you possibly innovate in clinical medicine when doctors have to follow a prescribed flowchart of what they can prescribe to their patients? So much of innovation throughout history in clinical medicine has been doctors experimenting with the consent of their patients to try something new. And now doctors are afraid to do that because they'll get sued. And governments are actively shutting down medical practitioners who deviate from the medical guidelines, even if no one has been hurt. They've gone a little overboard with that police power. So it's created this field of medical tourism. So people will go to Latin America, Caribbean, Turkey, Malaysia, sometimes Singapore, Germany, Switzerland, for medical care, really high quality at a very low price. And so what if we could sort of institutionalize that? What if we had a country that was self-consciously interested in providing the best quality, best evidenced healthcare at the lowest possible cost? And so that is one of the projects we really want to investigate here. And we like Latin America, and we like Montenegro thus far. Thailand is also pretty good for this. So yeah, we can get into that in a bit. But just speaking about DSI specifically, so DSI is, for those who are new to the term, a movement in the scientific community to rely less on centralized authorities, so the government, big corporations, etc., and to finance scientific research through crypto rails. So people can pool capital through the Web3 infrastructure and deploy it into bio DAOs that invest in these projects, whether the projects are academic labs doing radical science that's outside of the prevailing dogma or paradigm, or biotech companies doing really radical, interesting things that VCs often won't fund because it's perceived as too risky. And VCs are actually not really risk-loving entities. And we owe a lot of that to family offices and investors like Peter Thiel, for example, or Balaji and Naval for actually backing these out there ideas that have such enormous potential. So through the DSI crypto rails, we can finance these projects. VitaDAO has financed, you know, over a dozen at this point. And then you can take the intellectual property that results from those projects and you can put it on chain and fractionalize ownership so that individuals have control, governance rights over what is done with that science. So imagine that, you know, type 1 diabetics had some influence or control over the intellectual property around insulin and other therapeutics that companies developed with the use of these patients' own bodies, right? You can't develop a drug, you can't develop insulin unless you're giving it to diabetics, right? So why shouldn't the patients, especially if they're investing, contributing to the study, have some rights and control? And we ran into this issue with various big pharmas like Eli Lilly or Sanofi charging huge amounts of money in this sort of weird cartel manner for insulin when it doesn't need to be so expensive. And so these are just a few case studies of how things are going wrong with the current system. And we may be able to institute new structures abroad. So I'll pause there if you want to dive into
it. Yeah, and this is so important because that just shows how much urgency there is, right? So these are massive problems, right? The myths or the bad incentives in healthcare are affecting like everyone. But at the same time, most people have a very strong status quo bias. Right. So science is organized in a way that it just benefits a lot of people that are willing to go through sort of other initiation rituals instead of get all your titles and all your credentials. And then you basically have an easy life. Right. So it wouldn't work if it wouldn't create this class of people, intellectuals and sort of institutionalized scientists that benefit massively from it, right? So at the same time, sort of, I think you know Terence Keeby, I'd still love to have in my podcast, who talked about how basically government funding of science crowded out privately funded science, right? So there is this bad argument out there that science is a public good, therefore the government has to fund it, which is a non sequitur, right? So in the crypto world, we know that we can finance public goods also privately, right? So the only advantage that the government or the state has is that it can force people to buy its product, right? That's, you know, knowing what we know, how free markets and emergent order work, not a very good or efficient way to do it. And that is very bad for science all over the world, right? Because you're basically competing with free, with like very well-funded or capitalized scientific institutions. That means we have to, like startups, speak to the people who care most about it, right? And that's within DeSci, Longevity, for example, or SynBio, because many of these innovations, they don't thrive in the current system, right? So longevity or aging is not considered a disease by the National Science Foundation, I think. You can edit the facts. And so that means there's this urgency. If you really care about the science, like really care about the science, then you're automatically questioning why are things done the way they are now. And then you end up sort of with some of the conclusions that we're coming up with. Hey, this is not how, so we have this, we incentivize to question how the system works and look for alternatives, right? And that's what forms kind of our moral innovation. Like life is good, death is bad. So we need to, and this is where exit voice and loyalty comes in, right? So it's actually this three-pronged paradigm, right? So loyalty basically means you are part of the system. You're not questioning it, right? You're benefiting from it. And then voice is you realize the problems with it. So you try to reform it. And many people are doing that within the United States, right? So it's very hard to escape the insight that it can't go on like that, right? I mean, when it comes to costs and when it comes to the efficiency and everything like that. But it needs the exit option too, right? Because it's an uphill battle. So, right. So doing reform in these very big jurisdictions is just very, very hard. And you just have very, very rare, if any, opportunity. So exit isn't necessarily just quit, right? It's more like create this laboratory for innovation, right? So we're going to these places like Montenegro, like Prospera, like Uruguay, maybe, or other Latin American countries, to experiment on better ways to do these things, right? And then we can bring back these ideas, that innovation, together with experimental data and experience to other jurisdictions and show them, hey, it works, right? This is kind of how startups work. This is why startups are so important, to constantly reimagine and disrupt the status quo, right? This is how the system works, right? So you get, as an industry, you get old and incumbent and you protect your interests. So only through that open competition, through entrepreneurs that are willing to challenge the status quo and have an incentive to succeed big, can you then sort of identify the weaknesses in the status quo and sort of have this positive creative destruction of the state and of the status quo that is ending up in, well, better products for consumers and everyone. And it's, I believe that's the at the heart of how civilization grew through the Industrial Revolution, through the Information Age, to hopefully, if we can continue or create sort of that space of like open competition and permissionlessness, to an even higher and higher state of our civilization. So that's why we need these zones, right? And we need to speak to the ones, to the renegade scientists, to the biohackers, to the entrepreneurs that are not happy with the current system, to help us build some of these other jurisdictions and, you know, figure out better ways there to get off the ground what they want to, the immense gifts from the science and from the technology that these entrepreneurs have and give them to the world.
Agreed. Yeah. And there's so much science sitting on the shelf that no one's doing anything with. It's just a shame. By the way, I'd love to give a shout out to, you mentioned renegade scientists. It reminded me of the new book, Paper Belt on Fire, by Michael Gibson. from 1517 Fund. He helped launch the Thiel Fellowship, and he wrote this excellent book. The name actually comes from Balaji, the source of all good and original things, our god King Balaji. It's an excellent treatise on, you know, how the system of education is broken, both higher education and lower, and, you know, how we can basically encourage smart people to just go ahead and do the thing that they want to do with their lives rather than racking up those credentials and wasting their most energetic creative years of their life and being brainwashed within the system. So pivoting to the aging aspect in the network state, and then we're almost out of time, so we can finish up on Avalon. I asked myself, what would you do if you knew that aging was malleable and even curable, and progress wasn't being made nearly fast enough with the current structure? What would you do? What's the most extreme measure that you would take to 100x innovation in longevity biotech? But while we're at it, the same framework would apply to all technology and theory, especially life sciences, like synthetic biology or energy, which are major bottlenecks on technological progress, as you've given presentations on previously. This is why you and I have been investigating building a Singapore in Latin America, or a Dubai equivalent in Latin America. And we are this winter going to go meet with some governments to basically pitch them on a Prospera-style special economic zone. There are ongoing negotiations with the Montenegro government as well. It'd be good to have one in Europe too. And we're calling this project Avalon, which is after the old Arthurian King Arthur, ancient mythical city in England somewhere. There are some countries that we like for this: Costa Rica, Uruguay, Panama. And one of the key unique selling points of these sovereign zones is the ability to attract global talent from everywhere. So imagine if the top 0.01% of talent and capital from China, Russia, Ukraine, America wanted to go to some new place. There's just nowhere with critical mass already. So people are being drawn to Miami or Dubai or Singapore. Those are the ones that Balaji mentioned. But those are restricted. I mean, Singapore doesn't really want new people there. It's quite expensive. Dubai is not the most straightforward government, shall we say. It's not, resource self-sufficient. It's in the desert. It's doesn't seem very sustainable. It's highly dependent upon imports. And Miami, again, is within the United States jurisdiction. So we like these Latin American regions, and the demographics are in our favor going forward in Latin America. They're major commodity producers in a world where paper assets are losing their value, as we recognize that they were never worth what people claimed in the first place. Returns to those real physical tangible things. So those are some of the reasons why we like Latin America, but maybe you can elaborate on your thinking.
Yeah, sure. I mean, so the idea came out of the time we spent together in Zuzalu, right? And sort of the thinking, well, where can we go to? What can we do? And my suggestion was, or the suggestion we developed, or the strategy was that longevity network state in Latin America. And why not just Prospera, right? So why not just as one place? And the idea was that would be a single point of failure, right? And longevity, we need to set the foundations for like a decades, maybe hundreds of years long trend. So for that, we need to be anti-fragile and diversified and ideally have 3 to 4 different jurisdictions, right? Also, secondly, even Prospera is probably the most forward-thinking jurisdiction in the world and the highest degree of legal autonomy for like longevity, biotech, or anything. But at the same time, it faces political trade-offs, right? So its first and foremost mission is to create positive externalities and economic growth for Honduras. And for that, it needs to survive. So, there are things that we're doing that are out of the Overton window, right? So people don't like the sound of like gene therapy or GMOs or some things like that, and don't have sort of the background education or the awareness or the nuance to sort of adjudicate whether it's a good thing or not. So any of those things that are too out of the Overton window create sort of points of attack for Prospera and for any of these jurisdictions, right? So that's why you don't want to have these single points of failure, because these jurisdictions all face political trade-offs, right? So
yeah.
And then also, do we want to build our own complete city? You know, that's a lot to build. It would take a lot of years. So maybe we can go to market faster by working off of existing governance providers and jurisdictions. So the idea is therefore to have like 3 or 4 different jurisdictions. And in each of them, we try to tap into what's already there, like local talent, infrastructure, you know, history of clinical trials, medical tourism, manufacturing capability, doctors, and like a talent, and sort of, you know, have like a multi-jurisdictional network state where we have a couple of entrepreneurs building companies and develop a local ecosystem that's ideally making as much use as possible of existing talent, right? Because that's been my experience with Prospera. The reason it works really well is that it's very strongly supported by Honduran stuff, right? And it's like 50-70% and Hondurans that live there and that are sort of at the core of building Prospera. And I think that's key for any of these projects to succeed, is that they create these positive local externalities. And then I think by having 3 or 4 different jurisdictions, could be between Prospera, Puerto Rico, Uruguay, or Panama, or Costa Rica, that's what we find out, right? So we're going to meet with governments in these regions and sort of with startups and VCs and try to see what's the potential for being a node in that jurisdiction. And can we prove that we can sort of encourage or incentivize entrepreneurs like us that we take with us on a journey to move to these places permanently or semi-permanently for a couple of years to build these ecosystems. That would be the hypothesis that we'd be seeking to validate with that longevity network state.
Exactly. Yes. And, you know, these places like Dubai and Singapore and Hong Kong, their selling points were low taxes and high ease of doing business. And that's great, but I think we can go further than that because each of them have their downsides, as we just discussed. Hong Kong kind of off the table because the Chinese government is coming in. You know, Singapore, it's full, it's very expensive, it's far away. Dubai, similar issues. And so what if we could have that, but we could also have like a nice weather place with low taxes, maybe not zero, but very low, high ease of doing business, easy to incorporate companies really quick, and it's resource self-sufficient. And it's a small enough country that they want to be agile, they want to be innovative. And if we were to bring a couple thousand people, it would make a difference to them. So Honduras, it's a large population. Many of these countries, they're too big. We wouldn't move the needle. Like Switzerland has a pretty good model. But even if we move 10,000 people to Switzerland, it wouldn't really make a difference to them. They're already doing a lot right. And so there's a lot more low-hanging fruit and room for improvement in some of these other jurisdictions. And so, you know, I kind of ask myself, you know, all of these digital nomads, of which we are multiplying, there's so many more digital nomads all the time. And I think that'll just continue as technology advances. We'll want a place to settle down. So digital nomads are not going to want to constantly be on the move for the rest of their lives. They're going to want to have children, families, et cetera. There are advantages to staying put in a certain place for at least half the year. And so I asked myself, like, what would I need? What would I look for in an ideal place to live and settle down? So for me, it's good weather, low taxes, good English speaking. The locals are friendly. They want immigrants, ease of doing business, and so on. We have a whole list that we've developed. And some of these countries in Latin America really do check most of those boxes. Uruguay, I have a good feeling about. We've gotten good feedback from people interacting with the government there. But the downside, of course, is that it's far away. It's an 8-hour flight from Miami south, which could prove to be an advantage in the case of nuclear winter or nuclear war, or, you know, something happening, because it is a little bit more remote between Argentina and Brazil. Costa Rica is closer, although it's already been sort of discovered. It's rather expensive. Panama is also fairly sophisticated already. So we're hopefully going to figure that out. So this is sort of a plug to those listeners who made it to the end of the podcast. You must be true blue, very interested people. We have a group that you can get in touch with myself or Nicholas, say via LinkedIn, and just tell us a bit about your interest, and we will add you to this top secret elite vanguard of founders were going to go on this expedition in Latin America and scope out some of these locations. So do get in touch with either of us if you're interested. And also if you're interested in investing in this project, it will be making some sort of return in the future. And so do get in touch because we are raising capital for it in the near future. So yeah, with that, thanks so much, Nicholas, for coming on the podcast. Is there anything we can do to help you? So you're raising your next fund. Of course, investors should get in touch and go on the website, Infinitive Fund for the thesis. I can warmly endorse Nicholas. And so, yeah, let us know if there's anything else we can do, how people can follow you and so on.
Sure. Thanks for having me on, Sebastian. This was fun. Like, listeners can find me, the Stranded Technologies podcast that you mentioned. They can find me on Twitter and on LinkedIn under just my regular name, Nicholas Amsinger. I'm pretty easy to find there. And yeah, looking forward to connect with anyone who wants to invest in that ecosystem that I'm helping to put together and who wants to build, right? So the most important resource or scarce factor in the world to make any of the things happening that we're doing is entrepreneurs, right? So entrepreneurs are carrying the world on their shoulders. So if you are intrigued by what we're doing here and you're looking for the next venture that you want to build, by any means, please reach out to me and Sebastian, and we'd love to involve you in some of these things that we're doing.
Perfect. Amen to that. Well, thanks again, Nicholas.
Thanks.